Hello, everybody, and welcome or welcome back to Addicted to Recovery, the interactive memoir. I'm Tara Voice, your creator, host, keeper of chronicles. I wonder if anyone will get that reference. And since no one sent me any alternative sassy nicknames, I guess I'll leave it at that. This is a podcast where I reflect on my experience in active addiction, usually through the lens of chapters I've written about my past, and I invite you to interact with me about it, ideally by reaching out to me at interactivememoir@gmail.com. You can also join the Facebook group to get in on the discussion or to be informed of any updates, and all the links to that is in the show notes along with some other resources I think can be useful to people. And speaking about resources, I also wanted to let you all know about Basecamp. It's a new outpatient clinic based in the West Island of Montreal around where I am, but they also have online services for wherever you may be. I mean, oh God, I know from experience that so many places have really long waiting lists or super restrictive prices. I know I felt hopeless and alone at times, but I wasn't, and no one is, and that's the message they want to communicate over at Basecamp, and I wanted to show my full support. You can find further information in the show notes. Alright, so we're going to get into a new chapter really soon. I feel like it's been a long time. It has been a long time. But first, I did want to jump a little bit into the interactive part of it. And the question was if I still get cravings for alcohol, and the answer remarkably is no, I do not. I get cravings to have different feelings than the ones I'm currently having. Like today I feel this kind of pit in my stomach for absolutely no reason, but I now don't think of alcohol as a resource to change my state. Any time I'd been sober for a while and relapsed, it wasn't a craving for alcohol itself so much as a craving to be having a different emotional experience than the one I was having. And the good thing is, thanks to a lot of therapy and rehab and sober time, I have a pretty good repertoire of better ways to manage my emotions. But sometimes, even more important than my ability to change my state is my ability not to. Like my ability not to diagnose it or try to medicate it, just to let it be. Oh, oddly, even though I don't have any conscious cravings for alcohol, I get drunk all the time in my dreams. I mean, like 2 nights in a row I've had alcohol dreams. And honestly, I love those dreams. And no, not because I get to kind of drink and get away with it, but because it reminds me how it felt to be completely lonely. Not how it used to feel to be drunk, how it used to feel to be scheming and hiding and racked with guilt and hoping I can get away with it and making mental calculations of who I had told what to and whether anyone might have seen me at the liquor store or if I'm talking funny, walking funny, you know, and just that profound isolation of just being thoroughly in my own head, protecting the relationship with alcohol. But the great thing is, when I have one of those dreams is I get to wake up and I get to have a kind of Christmas Carol moment where Scrooge wakes up and realizes it was a dream and he has a chance to live his life differently, even though Scrooge was still being a bit of a jerk at the time when he was having those dreams, so it's really not a perfect metaphor, but you catch my drift. Perhaps one of the reasons why I don't really get many cravings is I have good subconscious reinforcement of the consequences of what that would look like. All right, time to get into the chapter. Considering it's been a while, I would imagine we need a refresher. So, previously on Addicted to Recovery, I go to rehab. I am woefully disappointed with all the ways it does not resemble a movie. I am woefully disappointed with how I feel about myself when I'm sober. I am indignant about the structure, I am indignant about the rules, I am indignant about the other residents, and, you know, pretty much anything else I could be indignant about, I am indignant about it. And so I bring you Resident of the Day. The last month at Portage, I was looking for an escape route. Now, this wasn't a literal Shawshank Redemption crawl through the sewers kind of escape. It was an escape through focus, which I was determined to be on anything but my role in the community, the therapeutic model, or even my alcoholism. I realized it was almost intoxicatingly distracting to focus on everyone else and their problems. Like my roommate, who snored like an asthmatic dragon, and when she wasn't snoring, she was crying or whining, snoring, crying, and whining. She never shut up, and I just knew she had smuggled black eyeliner into the place. I could tell. I could tell because I tried to use a black ballpoint pen on my eyes and found black on an otherwise naked face was too obvious. I also knew because I went through her stuff and found it. And sure, the center thought they could keep people from hooking up by putting boys on one side and girls on the other, like only straight people exist in the world. But of course, two of the girls were hooking up in their bunk bed. One of them wasn't even gay, but since I was pretty sure she'd never get into college, I guess rehab was the closest thing she'd get to do her cliche experimentation. At least they kicked her out for being ingenuine in her confession, but I don't know why they kept the other one. They may as well have just given her permission. Maybe it was because the counselor who had made that decision and who generally weighed in on our potential or our limitations was fucking 21. It was hard to tell from all the tanning bed and cracked end damage. I'd thought she was at least 30. I found it more than a little bit disturbing that I'd been complaining of all these profound feelings of dislocation to somebody whose brain hadn't fully reached maturation. If I wasn't getting better, it wasn't my problem. Was this place some sort of social experiment? Let's just hand the druggies over to children. But, you know, it was okay. Because now, I had Gavin. At Portage, though we were being therapized in the same institution, the women were not allowed to talk to the men. We ate in the same cafeteria, but we weren't even allowed to make eye contact with them. However, if we had a day outing, like a doctor's appointment, we'd then check in at the downtown inpatient building after concluding our business and wait there until the end of the day so we didn't get up to any mischief. When I dutifully reported back directly after my appointment, there was Gavin by the doorway, smoking a cigarette, looking like a young Bon Jovi, making smoking look as sexy as lung damage can be. I'd been eyeing him since my first day on the inside, and until we were carted back to the center, we had a brief window to talk. He had been transferred there from prison, which shocked me. Too pretty for prison, I thought. Though he could have been a thief, because he was certainly very skilled at stealing hearts. He shared with me that his biggest problem, other than heroin, was women. It was its own addiction, and I fantasized about becoming his new problem. So back at the center, I had my new obsession. I hadn't been able to justify crushing on some guy with whom I'd never spoken and ridiculed the girls who had such emotions, but things were different now with me and Gavin. We had a real connection. For example, I knew he loved books, and now I noticed him reading them. I'd be swooning as he bustled between buildings with a book tucked under his arm. Fitzgerald, The Beautiful and Damned, well, how deliciously apropos, some Orwell also telling, as we were indeed in a dystopia. I wrote down the titles in a notebook so I could find those same books on my next exit, so I'd hopefully be able to start thinking some of the same thoughts as he was thinking. Since my most compelling occupation had become fantasizing about Gavin, I became a little bit more snide in my style of participation. One activity we did every morning was an unburdening, where we shared something from the day before or any time in the past that we wanted to get off our chests. It was a confessional of sorts. I'd already bemoaned the perceived shame-mongering tactics of this exercise, believing it was designed to have us manufacture reasons to feel bad about ourselves, to keep us in our place. I was becoming slightly paranoid. One day I shared, "Today, I don't feel particularly bad or guilty about anything, which makes me feel insecure because I know I should feel bad or guilty about something all the time. So maybe I'm doing this wrong. Oh, wait, there. Now I feel bad and guilty." Another day, playing with fire, as this kind of thing could have residents and staff alike down your throat, I confessed to my crush on Gavin by saying, "I admit to having romantic thoughts about a boy on the other side. Though I have no plans to act on this and have not violated any boundaries and have not even made eye contact with the man, I recognize we must take thought crime seriously, and I am ashamed of my impure thoughts, and I will try to think differently." Remarkably, they didn't pursue the matter with me. Maybe because the primary counselor that day was francophone and didn't understand exactly what I was saying, or maybe because I had become so peevish and salty they didn't see the point in bothering. When I wasn't seething over the incompetence of the counselors and the personality deficits of my compatriots, I was puzzling over the logistics of mine and Gavin's sober nuptials. And more specifically, whether it's okay for addicts or alcoholics to get wasted on important days like their own weddings. Surely this whole abstinence thing was just a suggestion, and there must be cheat days, like with a diet. Surely I'd be allowed some reprieve. I wasn't expected to live a joyless life forever, right? And just by that line of thinking, something should have clicked that I was missing the point. But I was almost a decade short of believing, even theoretically, that a sober life is its own reward, so long as I saw sobriety itself as suffering and alcohol as a privilege that had been removed, I was not going to last. Though I knew that mine and Gavin's wedding was unlikely, it was a stand-in for all the other occasions that would be robbed of pleasure without alcohol, and it was also a stand-in for all the events that could theoretically be considered exceptions. If I only got drunk on special occasions, that isn't a problem. And what about things like first dates? The whole business of courting and sexuality could not be attended to sober. What about all the people in my life that I knew and the fact that some of them would die before me? Alcohol is pretty much a universal grieving aid. The more I considered all these exceptions, the more I was consoled that you didn't really have to give it up completely. Kind of like when you're breaking up with someone you're still in love with, convincing yourself that you can still be friends, right? Convincing yourself that that wouldn't be complicated at all. When I had my first non-medical day outing, I was suddenly overcome with appreciation for the simplest of liberties. The freedom to hug my parents. The freedom to buy a Diet Coke and drink it. The freedom to apply mascara. The freedom to just grab a snack from the pantry. The freedom to use the internet. Where I could see everyone carrying on with their lives without me. Even before it was a popular hashtag, I'd always suffered from a profound fear of missing out, that everyone would have the greatest time without me, that I'd hear about the legendary moments only in other people's stories, that nobody particularly needed me around in the first place, or worse, that if I wasn't there to remind them, people would just forget about me. That maybe I'd never been very important to them in the first place. I messaged Max, who consoled me that she had not, indeed, forgotten I existed. In fact, she consoled me that not only she, but the city itself mourned my absence. "Montreal misses you," she wrote. And those words activated something in me. Though I'd already begun planning my exit strategy and rehearsing how I would present it to my family, the idea that the city, as a living thing, was missing something without me accelerated a kind of egoic urgency, What would Montreal's literary scene do without me? The university itself would likely collapse upon itself in dismay at my absence. And of course, the real question was, who was I without these things? And the answer was, I had no fucking idea. The longer I was away, the longer I felt my sense of a stable identity crumbling. Surprisingly, no one there was impressed by the book of my own writing I kept tucked under my arm like a talisman, secretly hoping people would ask to read it and then fawn over my brilliance. Beyond my crush on Gavin, there was no way of actually interacting with him to validate my desirability. Running around the gymnasium like a rabbit on speed every time we had access to it and picking at my food to try to reactivate my eating disorder did not bring me the same solace it once did, because I couldn't enact any bizarre food rituals by myself, as I was never by myself. I couldn't dress up, do my makeup, and be that eccentric girl. Though I even sang for the residents once to show that I could perform sober, really, I was hoping everyone would assure me that that was who I was. It's okay, Tara. We get it now. You're a performer. Even being that girl who drinks too much, a kind of tragic anti-hero, had been a concrete persona. Here, I had nothing, and it was terrifying. I tried to talk through some of this in a rare, vulnerable moment in group, explaining that I felt more identified with my drinking self than my sober self, so I was having trouble integrating the two, because there were elements of the drinking self that had been true to me before I just became a person who was drinking all the time, like a desire to create and connect. The more I drank, the more the two personalities felt distinct, but I knew it hadn't always been that way. It was more confusing, as there were many people who I cared about who only really knew the drinking me and had never even really met my sober self. And then a girl snarkily pointed out that none of us have met her either, because that apparently was not the real me. I was constantly being called out for my lack of authenticity whenever I either used humor to deal with my past, or if I tried to work out my problems analytically rather than emotionally. Never mind that it had always been a hallmark of my personality. It wasn't the right kind of real for me to be. Was I supposed to be more real, like contestants on reality TV where everyone's just yelling at each other constantly? I mean, a day at my center would be MTV's wet dream. And sure, yes, sometimes I was sarcastic or snarky. But that was often because I was always accused of being fake, even when I was leading with sincerity, just because I processed things a little differently and other people didn't much relate to me. Meanwhile, the residents that had meltdowns or caused trouble and then apologized for it were often celebrated for their authenticity and were awarded things like Resident of the Day, which was really just a photocopy from a children's coloring book, but it was some of the only positive reinforcement we were given. My wheedling, eyeliner-smuggling bunkmate had 3 such awards ostentatiously taped to the bed frame, which I thought was bullshit because she was such a pain in the ass. But because she was such a pain in the ass, she was often improving or overcoming her pain in the assness before discovering new ways to be a pain in the ass and then becoming slightly less so and being rewarded for it. So then, rather than try to work out my real fears about my identity and place in the world which were labeled inauthentic, I made a false confession in group, copping to all the ways that I, too, was a pain in the ass. I was resisting the therapy. I was not implicated in the community. I intellectualized everything. I really was just a walking defense mechanism because I just didn't know what I was doing. Oh, and I cried. On cue. Take that, theater school that expelled me. The thing is, this was all somewhat true, but when I said it, it was a tactic, so I got to tell myself I didn't mean it, so I could go back to doing exactly what I admitted I was doing, Since I had made this grand declaration of all the ways I was bullshitting everybody, who would doubt my authenticity now? Oh, and I was awarded Resident of the Day that day. And of course, from there, it was natural to assume I had peaked in that environment, and it was time to start planning my exit. Though I do not have a crystal ball, and even if I did, it would still just be a round chunk of crystal, it is possible that my terror of not knowing who I was sober and who that person would be in the world was just the discomfort I had to learn how to sit with, that maybe I was on the verge of pushing past something. It's also possible that I just wasn't ready, not just to stop drinking, though there's that as well, but to be without all the layers of costumes I collected to convince myself it was okay to exist. Maybe I would have found out that I was okay without them. But I didn't wait to find out. I started working on persuading my family that I'd learned all I could there, and to stay longer might actually be counterproductive, especially with all those people from the wrong side of the tracks who might corrupt me, as I knew how to play on my mother's prejudices and anxieties. Now, I was an adult, and I was not there by any legal necessity. But I was so deeply dependent on my family, both emotionally and financially. It seemed to me that the people I had to convince I was ready to leave were my parents. I mean, certainly not the center's employees, certainly not my fellow residents, and certainly not even myself. I believed truth was just a matter of crafting a story that I could tell convincingly. At a point, I barely recognized that the discrepancy between my inventions and my contradictory actions should be of concern to me. In the absence of any stable sober identity, I thought, well, perhaps I can just construct an entirely new me, who, in this case, would have an affinity for business suits. If I could, as everyone said, completely reinvent myself without alcohol tying me down, why not become a person who was not only a writer, but someone who cared about business? I imagined myself in a tailored number, like the ones Romy and Michelle wear to their reunion, going about the city with a briefcase full of plastic-protected scribings, convincing the deep-pocketed elite that I should be teaching writing workshops to creatively frustrated housewives in Westmount, who would surely pay great sums to hear an unpublished 24-year-old plagiarize her poetry teacher's assignments. But really, how would they know either way? I would be commanding authority with my shoulder pads and tan pantyhose. It didn't really occur to me that in creating a whole new me, it should be at least somewhat grounded in reality. And not just in terms of my fashion sense, but in terms of my confidence and the reality of my empty resume. It's probably for the best that I didn't try to persuade my parents with this particular fantasy. What really got them on board was the mishandling of a toothache. I had a brain-blasting, lunacy-inspiring toothache. I wanted to call my parents to get them to make a dentist appointment. But oh no, it wasn't phone time. Even if I could make a phone call out of phone time, it might take a full day to approve that request. Eventually, I snuck away and made a phone call on the sly, near deranged with pain. My parents got me an appointment for the next day, but there was further discipline coming my way. I had made a call without permission. I certainly couldn't go out the next day. There wasn't even anyone left in the center to properly approve that request. There was a back and forth between me and the residents and counselors, me and my parents and the staff at the center. Outrage was expressed. I mean, an untreated abscess could lead to death. Threats were uttered, and the next day, when they picked me up, they were primed to be convinced it was time to leave that uncivilized hellhole. When I went back after my appointment to pack up my things, my counselor took me aside and said, "Well, it's getting warm out. I guess the terraces are calling." And then any misgivings I had about leaving were smashed completely. If, after knowing me for months, she really still thought terrasses were what motivated my drinking, then she clearly had never even bothered to try to understand me. Okay, so now that I've concluded the portage arc of this memoir, I did want to make sure it was clear that I was never at any point trying to slander Portage or call them out or anything like that. This is a first-person memoir with an extremely unreliable narrator, considering I was either drunk or mentally unwell most of the time. Do I think it was a great fit for me? No. Do I think I was ready to get sober at that point anyways? Also, no. Just because I wasn't drinking when I was in the rehab doesn't mean that my head was all of a sudden screwed on straight. And you know, all the ways I didn't think it was a good fit for me might be exactly the ways it could be a good fit for somebody else. I would never want to be the reason someone does not seek help. And I know a lot of people have had success with that particular institution. In the same way, you wouldn't expect me to have a reliable character assessment of some guy I had a messy love affair with. Consider this the rehab version of a messy love affair. Though I do find it fascinating the way that I did demonize that institution for such a long time. I used it as a scapegoat for my relapses. I used it as the reason I did not go back to rehab for another 3 years afterwards. And yeah, I certainly did feel misunderstood there. And they probably should have had better systems in place for dental emergencies, but you would have think that they kept me in a dungeon and flogged me regularly. But what I have come to realize is it represented a victim card I could play, and for a really long time I liked feeling like a victim because then I didn't have responsibility for my own actions. If the rehab had failed me, then it wasn't my fault I was still being a fall-down drunk and hurting everyone in my life. For a while, I thought victimhood was a kind of currency I could cash in for extra drunk time. Or extra forgiveness, perhaps. Extra chances. But the more victim cards I accumulated and played, the less empowered I felt to actually make any lasting change. But now, I'm trying to come to a sort of middle ground in which I can acknowledge that at times I have been hurt and let down by people, by institutions, by life. But then also taking responsibility for what those things are going to mean to me and how I'm going to behave going forward. We don't always choose exactly what happens in our lives, but we can choose the meaning we give to the things that happen. And that meaning is generally what's going to decide what we do next. Since I wasn't as conscious of this at the time, I definitely extracted the wrong meaning from my time at Portage. Because as much as you could say I had an attitude problem, and I did, my experience there also made manifest some of my worst insecurities. Like, maybe I really did need alcohol to be likable or to fit in. Or further to that, maybe the real me stripped down of the alcohol and all the performative personality I had co-created with alcohol was just not particularly likable to me or anybody else. I started drinking because I was, at first, just really sensitive to rejection and wanted to fit in. And then, lo and behold, my first experience in rehab, you take away the alcohol and nobody likes me and I don't fit in. I felt like I was in grade 5 all over again, being, you know, teased for being weird or the way I talked. And sure, I have a certain kind of bravado about my nonconformity, but, you know, nonconformity was less of a choice and rather just kind of a consequence of my personality. And so, you know, when I felt rejected, I became rejecting, and after that, I wasn't really very open to anything the people had to say to me. I felt like I was trapped back in a prepubescent self with a bunch of mean school kids telling me all the ways I would never be one of them. I mean, in grade five, I'd had two coping mechanisms, escapism and imitation. But since I'd linked alcohol to that kind of chameleon behavior and didn't really know how to shapeshift without it anymore, that just kind of left escapism and, well, retaliative rejection. Even that staged meltdown I had in group that awarded me resident of the day was maybe not so much about me proving that I could game the system so much as, you know, a desperate attempt to just have the people there treat me with a little bit more compassion. And maybe even see if I could try to imitate the way other people were approaching recovery, if maybe something would click in me. But you know, it didn't. No more than 12-step membership helped me until I found a way to navigate it that was true to me. And I wish I could have had the insight at the time that how I felt in those few months didn't indicate that that's what sobriety was, and that the social dynamics there were not necessarily reflective of how I would now feel amongst other people for the rest of my life. But in the end, that's the meaning that got linked up to that experience that recovery is painful, sobriety itself is full of suffering, and that all those nasty feelings of never belonging or not being good enough that I had been escaping with alcohol as soon as I learned how to drink would be right there waiting for me if I ever let them take away my alcohol again. Portage certainly did not create my sensitivities or my wounds, but at a certain point, I had to learn how to stop picking at those wounds, not to let a few nasty suburban kids dictate my self-worth as a fully grown adult, to stop clinging to my bullying or perceived mistreatments as a kid as a kind of talisman, to realize that the fact that I had been through a bit of rejection when I was a kid didn't give me a right to keep treating myself in a way that would also end up hurting a lot of other people. And in the end, who could I blame that there weren't all that many people RSVPing to the pity party anymore? But like Portage and like so many other events in my life, I told myself the story that made it okay for me to keep drinking. A story that actually necessarily implied that neither I nor the people I claimed to care about had all that much value, and I really don't like that story anymore. It's a story where the bad guys win, and that's kind of sad when the bad guys are a bunch of snotty-nosed fifth graders, and it's also a story in which I let myself become one of the bad guys. And that's not my story anymore. Because I know I have way more to offer than that, and I know that you too have so much more to offer the world than you even know. Until next time.